From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional. Unfictional is KCRW's program of stories and original documentaries. It's a part of KCRW's Independent Producer Project, a laboratory for independent radio producers, writers, and performers. And today on the program, we've got another story from broadcasting legend Joe Frank. After several years away from the radio, he has a new batch of stories that has been premiering here on Unfictional. Joe Frank produced his unique brand of radio storytelling for three decades, not only entertaining listeners, but inspiring scores of radio producers. And most of them can probably still remember when they first heard a Joe Frank program.
I mean, I had never heard anything like it. There is just something incredibly direct and pure and intense about it. And it's just someone who's just talking to you and is just getting right into your brain.
That's Jonathan Goldstein. You may have heard the stories he's done for This American Life or the radio series he produces for the CBC in Canada and Public Radio International. It's called Wiretap. He told me that his whole view of radio changed after he was introduced to the work of Joe Frank by This American Life producer Ira Glass.
It made me realize that you could be an author. You could be an artist on the radio. It kind of showed me how radio could be really amazing at creating atmosphere. The mix of his music and the sound of his voice, which is a very attractive, handsome voice, you know, if such a thing could be said, that it comes together to create something, though of just so few parts, something that's so distinctly his, you know. I mean, you could turn on the radio and just hear a few seconds of it and know that you're listening to Joe Frank.
That's producer Jonathan Goldstein. And right now, on KCRW's Unfictional, here's a story from Joe Frank. It's called Thief.
One afternoon, when I was 8 years old, I went into my parents' bedroom and found a large coin in the top drawer of their bureau. It was very heavy, the size of a silver dollar, and had ancient markings written in Arabic or Hebrew or Chinese. I thought it was very beautiful, and I stole it and hid it in the steamer trunk in the back of my closet. And that was the beginning. Whenever my parents were out, I'd go into their bedroom and rummage through all their cabinets and drawers. I stole my mother's gold arrow pin, a glass statuette of a unicorn, a money clip with my father's initials on it, a very small pair of old rimless reading glasses, and a ceramic thimble with a picture of a blue rabbit. And sometimes my mother would say, "Did you see my beaded necklace anywhere?" Or my father would ask, "I can't seem to find my blue striped tie. Do you know where it is?" I felt they knew I was stealing from them, but were reluctant to confront me. Then, one afternoon when they were out, I found in the top drawer of their chest a red silk pouch with a gold braided drawstring. Inside it were small photographs tied in a black ribbon. And using the magnifying glass from my stamp collection, I looked at very old pictures in which I appeared as a child, but I recognized none of the people around me. In one, three men were gathered together in the snow, one holding me in his arms, standing with his foot on a frozen dead cow, smiling at the camera. In another, I was harnessed to a baby's high chair in the company of a group of people sitting at a table in an outdoor cafe. They were sipping coffee and laughing while the interior of the cafe was on fire. The last photo was taken in a dimly lit nightclub. A man sitting at a white piano, wearing a bandana, was accompanying a couple dancing the tango in a very sexually provocative way. On the far wall, I observed a large mural of the baby Jesus. The face of the Christ child bore an uncanny resemblance to the face of the child in the other photos. and I wondered why I had been chosen to resemble Christ in an Argentine dance club. I couldn't ask my parents about the pictures because that would have revealed that I'd been going through their drawers and stealing from them. Meanwhile, I began to notice that some of my own possessions were disappearing, bit by bit. A toy soldier, a harmonica, my favorite pair of old beat-up sneakers, and my Superman action figure. As more of my own things disappeared, I became even more compulsive about stealing from my parents. I stole pendants, lockets, silverware, antibiotics, small cushions from the chairs and couches, a light bulb from the lamp in the entrance hallway, two incandescent bulbs from the ceiling track lighting, and little beads of glass, one by one, from the chandelier in the living room. And over the course of a few months, the walls became barer, the furniture seemed more exposed, the house became darker. And it happened so gradually that my parents didn't seem to notice. While, at the same time, more of my own things continued to disappear. For everything I took away, something was taken from me, almost as though an undeclared war had started. It was like a game of nerves. We'd all sit at the dinner table, calmly talking about the day's events, but there was something in the look of my parents' eyes, some unspoken tension. My father would purse his lips and stare at me with his head tilted, his brow furrowed, eating very rapidly, looking around the room to see if anything else was missing, while my mother anxiously twirled her hair and drummed her fingers on the table. There seemed to be a great unspoken sense of fear, rage, betrayal, the feeling of an imminent explosion, as if we were teetering on the brink of violence. But none of us could confront the other. And in this atmosphere, sitting at the dinner table, I remember waiting for a chance to slip the pewter salt shaker in my pocket. And after I'd successfully stolen it, I returned to my room and found that my bicycle was missing. By this time, I'd taken to wearing hunting and fishing jackets with multiple pockets, both inside and out, so that I could stash more items. And by the end of the day, I'd have books, vases, figurines, shoes, gloves, and jewelry. And the steamer trunk in the back of my closet was so crammed with stuff that it was about to burst. Then, one day, I noticed that my parents had put up two surveillance cameras, one in the living room, the other in the kitchen, and there was a guard posted at their bedroom door, wearing a uniform, who stood with his hands folded. And that's when I began to barricade my bedroom at night. I put my chair and my desk against the door, boarded up all the windows, and placed a tripwire attached to a spring-loaded catapult that would hurl a firebomb at the slightest turn of my doorknob. And I continued to obsess about these pictures of me as a child, taken with members of an unrecognized family. And finally, I cracked. I marched out of my room and into the dining room, where my mother was cleaning the table, and my father was sitting, looking very sullen, and I confronted them. "Why did you leave those pictures of me as a child with people who are completely unfamiliar to me? Was it to suggest that I have no part in your lives? Or were you trying to drive me crazy?" My father stood up and said, "And so, there we have it, finally, an admission. You were the one who started this." "But I'm a child," I said. "You're adults. You should have explained to me that stealing was wrong. Instead, you started stealing from me. Is that appropriate parental behavior? Do you have any idea of the damage you've caused? Why did you do this to me? Did you think it would make me stronger? Did you think if you exposed me to betrayal and spiritual murder that you were tempering me to be able to face the realities of life? It's a wonder I haven't had a mental breakdown or a heart attack or attempted suicide or become someone who tortures little animals or cuts himself late at night. You've broken my heart. I'll never be able to trust anyone for the rest of my life." My mother began to cry. My father's face was red, and he was shaking. And how come I'm the only recognizable person in the pictures you had hidden away? Who are those people? Are you really my parents? Or was I adopted? What are you talking about? My father said. What pictures? And I went back to my room and gave my parents the old photos and the magnifying glass from my stamp collection. One of the few things of mine that hadn't disappeared. And they examined the pictures and they said, yes, it is you. But they didn't recognize any of the other people either. And we all shared a sense of bewilderment, wonder, and mystery, and went into the kitchen to get something to eat. But the refrigerator was empty, because I'd stolen everything in it, and there was only one chair left in the dining room, and none of us had eaten in 3 days. So we decided to go out to a family restaurant around the corner, where we felt a sense of oneness, that together we'd solve the mystery, because we loved each other, that eventually everything would be explained, and life would be good, and God would exist in a future grounded in faith. Raise money for the household, my parents rented the room above the garage to a co-ed at the university. Her name was Angelisa, and she was an exchange student from Romania. She was majoring in foreign relations and spent most of her time studying in her room. She joined us during meals and helped clean up the kitchen. She was sweet and modest and very beautiful, and I found it difficult to take my eyes off her. One afternoon, as I passed beneath her window, I watched her standing before a full-length mirror, with her hands behind her head, admiring her naked body. Night, as I lay in bed and thought about her, I felt a tantalizing tingling filled with vague expectation. I didn't know what was happening to me, as my body seemed to be drawn towards something from which it could not retreat, a mounting sense of excitement I'd never imagined possible, until I felt a volcanic eruption of pleasure that was overwhelming. I was in the throes of a staggering new experience, unlike anything I'd ever felt before. And so I fell in love with her. The next day, while she was away in class, I rummaged through her belongings and came upon a letter from my father. My dear Angelisa, the way you dress, the way you walk, the way you draw the water glass slowly from your lips, the way the soap smells of your perfume, the way, as you open your door and discover me standing there, your eyes widen and I can see your shoulders and your neck with their hot, irresistible, erotic scent. This morning, it was impossible to ignore the way you lingered behind my chair, leaning over me, your breasts touching the back of my head as you poured the coffee. Then you sat across from me, eating sausages and grits, licking your fingers one by one, and looking at me with an expression of such yearning, wanton abandon, and raw sensuality that it was hard to get through breakfast without choking on my pancakes or mindlessly pumping half a gallon of hot sauce onto my eggs. Love, Horace. I stood there in a state of shock. Once again, something I loved was being taken from me, and I put the letter in my mother's purse. Then I fled across the backyard and into the woods. As night fell, I wandered through a dark forest, my face and arms scratched by bushes and tree branches. I had only a canteen half filled with warm water, two candy bars, a stick of chewing gum, three baseball cards, a hard-boiled egg, and a photograph of Hitler, whom I hated and feared, even though he was long dead, but whose evil life was strangely fascinating to me. Finally, the following morning, I came out of the woods in front of a diner, where there was a beat-up truck parked next to a gas pump. Two children were playing in the dirt by the highway, and a dog wearing a spiked collar was chained to a Coke machine. I walked into the diner and saw a man dressed as a clown reading the Bible. He motioned to me to sit down next to him, and when I did, he leaned forward as if to whisper something to me, and a spray of water shot out of the flower in his lapel and into my eyes. Through the front door, he found that my mother and every stick of furniture were gone. Apparently, with a crew of movers, she'd taken everything. My father wondered why my mother hadn't even left a note when he noticed, in the fireplace, the smoldering remains of photo albums of their life together, pictures taken at birthdays and anniversaries and vacations, and a balled-up piece of paper. He unfolded it. It was a love letter she'd written to him when they first fell in love 30 years ago. "Oh God, I love you so much that my body aches for you. I find myself drawing pictures of you on the backs of envelopes and writing your name on message pads at the office. The very thought of your hands parting my silken hair and cradling my face and gently kissing me is enough to bring me to ecstasy." The next morning, my father walked into town and went to the bank to see what had happened to their joint savings account. He wasn't surprised to find it had been emptied and closed. He had about $40 in his pocket. Then he went to the local realtor to sell the house. But a phone call revealed that his mortgage was in arrears and his house had been foreclosed by the Farmers and Merchants Bank. He walked back to his former property and stared in amazement at a vacant lot littered with broken pieces of bricks, shattered masonry, plumbing, and electrical wiring. A tarpaulin was pulled over cardboard appliance boxes where homeless people were gathered around a fire. One man was roasting the remains of a chicken on a stick. Another, holding onto the foreclosure sign, was performing ballet exercises. And that's when I returned home, so to speak. My father embraced me with tears in his eyes. We walked to the college to find Angelisa, but she dropped out and returned to Romania. We began strolling aimlessly down a winding two-lane road. It began to rain. A semi-tractor trailer approached at great speed. We turned and stuck out our thumbs. The driver saw us and applied the brakes, but the vehicle's tires lost their traction on the rain-swept road, and the truck went into a skid with its wheels locked and jackknifed into a tree. My father was hit and instantly killed. The driver was slumped over the steering wheel, unconscious. I dragged him out of the cab and left him by the side of the road. Then, finding the vehicle only minimally damaged and in good driving order, I backed the truck up onto the road and sped away. Last week, I attended a lavish party celebrating my birthday. It was held at a palatial mansion and attended by beautiful young showgirls, overweight powerful businessmen, and children with gift bags of sweets and toys. At the front gate, footmen in liveried uniforms parked cars, while Nubian slave girls, holding high silver and gold inlaid trays of hors d'oeuvres and champagne, circulated through the festive crowd. The host, Alberto Munoz, who breeds the finest Arabian stallions, had pygmies imported from Central Africa to perform as jockeys and organized competitions where greyhounds, mounted by even smaller pygmies, raced around an elliptical track to the delight of everyone. Then Alberto bequeathed me a small lake in which model ships engaged in battles, firing miniature cannons to replicate the famous naval campaigns in history. I drive along a wide boulevard with an island in the middle, planted with beautiful shrubbery and flowering trees. And I join a crowd gathered in a plaza before a balcony where a fat man with a mustache, wearing a general's uniform with a plumed helmet, a gold-plated sword hanging from his belt, receives the adulation of the citizens. I'm taken on a private tour of the presidential palace, compliments of Alberto, with its marbled hallways, hushed meeting rooms, and green velvet lampshades. Alberto is the leader of a cartel heavily armed with weapons to use against other cartels waged in a war for control of the drug industry. A legislator who dares raise his voice in Congress to pass a law against Alberto's drug cartel is found suspended upside down against his front door, his throat slit, blood dripping on his porch. A journalist who pens a series of crusading articles against Alberto's relationship with corrupt politicians is found nailed to the floor of his hotel room, his internal organs spread around the floor. The leader of a celebrated anti-drug unit dies when his plane mysteriously explodes, killing everyone on board, the wreckage falling into a jungle filled with cocaine processing plants and amphetamine factories. The police and the cartel pretend to be engaged in a furious battle. The police stage mock raids on Alberto's drug processing facilities and arrest me and other members of the cartel and put us in a palatial prison with huge bedrooms and marble bathrooms, an Olympic-sized heated swimming pool, a brothel featuring the most gorgeous schoolgirls, the prison set on a beautiful, fragrant hillside with classical statuary. A few months later, with the warden's help, we escape amidst the sound of an alarm and wailing sirens, and an intense so-called manhunt is mounted. We hear soldiers wearing night vision goggles shouting to one another, dogs barking, helicopters flying overhead. We hear urgent orders being given over squawking radios, military vehicles racing back and forth, roadblocks set up. I go into hiding in Quintana, a small fishing village on Mexico's Caribbean coast, and stay in a small hotel with a courtyard sheltered by lime trees, coconut palms, avocado, and breadfruit. In the evenings, the guests of the hotel gather on the veranda, where a small thatched hut bar is set up, and drink margaritas as the sun goes down. When I was 6 years old, Superman was my hero. But every time I brought him up, my parents were dismissive. When I asked them what kryptonite was made of, and did it really come from a planet that had exploded millions of light years away, and why was it the one thing on Earth that was a threat to Superman's survival, they said it was a lot of nonsense. Even if they were right, I felt those were legitimate questions that deserved attention. But my parents insulted my curiosity. They asked me, if Superman was such a great fighter against crime, where was he during the Holocaust? Too busy foiling a bank robbery? To conceal his true identity, Superman pretended to be Clark Kent, a bumbling reporter for the Daily Planet. And I asked my parents how Superman could possibly succeed in assuming the role of a man who was his polar opposite. And my parents told me that he'd attended the actor's studio under the direction of Lee Strasberg, where he developed his craft. And I knew that every time a crime was in progress, Superman had to remove his Clark Kent costume and reveal his true heroic nature, sculpted like a Greek god. But of course, he had to change in secret, not only because he'd been brought up properly and was modest, but because he couldn't let anyone know that he was really Superman. He usually changed in a phone booth, but when I asked my parents where he'd go if none was available, they told me he changed under a manhole cover in the city's sewer. I knew they were mocking me. But even if Superman was just a silly comic book character that had no literary, intellectual, or aesthetic value whatsoever, he meant something to me. And when they robbed me of my belief in Superman, I lost faith in everything. Through Superman, I learned about courage and sacrifice and loyalty and responsibility and the difference between right and wrong, and that one should be respectful, because even Superman, with all his power, was always kind, thoughtful, and fair.
You've been listening to Thief, written and narrated by Joe Frank. Music recorded by Kenny Lyon, mixed by Ray Guarna. Featuring James Hara on guitar, and special thanks to Michael Story. A portion of this program was originally published in the New York Times. I'm Bob Carlson, producer of Unfictional, part of KCRW's independent producer project, with thanks to the Annenberg Foundation, the Goldhirsch Foundation, and the Roth Family Foundation. You can find past episodes at our website, kcrw.com/unfictional. You can like the show on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Unfictional. You can podcast the show or listen on demand with the KCRW mobile app. And if you do like the program, please tell your friends about it. I'm Bob Carlson, and however you choose to listen, I hope you'll join me next time for Unfictional on KCRW and KCRW.com.